culture to politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, a great nation where words matter. And right now, the word equality has been replaced largely in left-wing circles by the word equity. There is an equity movement. It is written about with insight and some shocking results and conclusions by Christopher Caldwell in a devastating new piece in National Review. And what he says is that the equity movement may be in the process of becoming the supreme law of the land, overriding even the Constitution. Well, what's the difference? Why does it make any difference? Equity, equality, liberty, and justice for all. Why is a word like this so important? Christopher Caldwell is a contributing editor of the Claremont Review of Books, and he is the author of The Age of Entitlement, America Since the 60s. And his piece on the equity movement is posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. It appeared originally in National Review. Christopher, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Why does this substitution of one word for another, or actually one word for a lot of others, why is this word so important and so dangerous right now?
Well, I think the growth, we've always talked about equality. I mean, it's in our, Declaration of Independence. It's what we aspired to in the civil rights movement. Something's happened since roughly the mid-1990s, around the time you saw the growth of the so-called critical race theory movement. And critical race theory has been, widely criticized by President Trump a few months ago, among others. And, it's really a very varied movement. There's a lot of things going on in it. But I'd say if there's one thing that unites all these thinkers in critical race theory, it's that their idea of civil rights no longer has non-discrimination at its heart. So that is, it's not a colorblind movement. It favors explicit actions by government that are race-based and that are intended to, shift opportunities from one race to another. And that process is called equity.
Well, you have a devastating quote in here from Ibram X. Kendi in 2019. And he, of course, the mega best-selling author. He now, I believe, is getting over $100,000 per speech. He's wanted everywhere. And in 2019, he said, the defining question is whether the discrimination is creating equity or inequity. If discrimination is creating equity, he writes, then it is anti-racist. If discrimination is creating inequity, then it is racist. So
right.
He's saying that discriminating against white people could be anti-racist?
That's right. So this kind of thing, when people start talking this way, it gets very confusing, and it sounds like, when you criticize what they're saying, it sounds like you're being a wiseacre. But this is exactly, that quote you just read is exactly what I'm talking about. Race, the belief at the heart of critical race theory is that, that the structures are racist, that the country's institutions are racist, that any gap between two groups of people, whether it be in, average per capita income or the percentage of that group that is in prison, any gap is evidence of racism. And so if you believe that, then to eliminate the gap by whatever means is anti-racism. So you need to think in racial categories in order to get over racism. And the problem is, as the proponents of political race theory actually see. They actually are quite clear about this. The problem is that the country's, the wider country's idea of anti-racism is treating everyone equally, and they want to get the country over that, and that's what equity is.
Okay, you also bring up something here, which I salute you, Christopher Caldwell, because it's a public service to make people aware of this, that the new senator from Georgia, Raphael Warnock, has introduced a bill called the Emergency Relief for Farmers of Color Act. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the difficulty is that this emergency relief excluded whites from its beneficiaries. In other words, if you happen to be white and you want to benefit from this emergency program, you're flat out of luck.
That's right. And
isn't that right. a violation of the 14th Amendment?
Yeah, well, that was, well, this is a confusing area. That was that bill that Warnock brought forward was altered a little bit and put into the COVID stimulus bill, which is now no longer a bill, it's a law. Now, how it's going to work, I'm not exactly sure, but Biden administration officials have been boasting about the equity effects of that stimulus bill, particularly at a press conference in late March. There was there's a lot of talking about how this bill would be the largest investment for specifically Native American programs, a boon for industries concentrated among entrepreneurs of color, as they called it. And the incoming Deputy Treasury Secretary is supposed to run a rolling racial equity review on those funds, on that $2 trillion worth of funds.
Uh-huh. And so, and by equity, they don't mean equality. They don't mean that, for instance, if you are black people are 13% of the American population, that doesn't mean there's a guarantee that you get 13% of the resources, the funds. In other words, they are suggesting that to deal with the inequality that exists in America today, there has to be more inequality in terms of distributing goodies and money from the government based upon race. Isn't this entire thing go back to the idea that somehow race is an intrinsic quality that requires some adjustment from a differential government treatment?
You know, I'm not sure what the origins are, but I totally agree with you that is the worry. The worry is that that people begin to that your racial category becomes the most important thing about you. That it comes to determine your your place in a hierarchy, and that would be the most dangerous end point of this. I think that it's already happening in certain limited areas of American government. So, for instance, I think you probably heard about the governor of Vermont, a Republican actually, who when he saw that the uptake of COVID vaccines among white Vermonters was higher as a percent per capita.
Okay, let's go back to that in just a moment if we can.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Christopher Caldwell. He is the author of a fascinating and important new piece, The Inequality of Equity. It's in National Review. It's also posted on our website at michaelmedved.com. We'll be right back. And on the Michael Medved Show, joined by Christopher Caldwell, who is a contributing editor of the Claremont Review of Books. He is the author of The Age of Entitlement, America Since the 60s. And he's the author of a substantial new piece called The Inequality of Equity, talking about the equity movement, which has become such a powerful force in American culture, in our educational system, in universities across the country, and even in our politics. The drive for reparations obviously is a key reflection of this equity idea, isn't it, Christopher?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. So what do you say? Let me try to play some, you'll pardon the expression, devil's advocates. And I'm not suggesting that the other side are devils. I'm just using a turn of phrase. Some hypothetical questions for Mr. Caldwell. Okay. Given the fact that the tremendous oppression and exploitation and subjugation of black people over the course of hundreds of years clearly had a devastating effect, and it clearly was based on racism. And given the fact that white people at the time that slavery and Jim Crow were going on benefited from this subjugation, exploitation, isn't it appropriate that the descendants of those oppressors be required to pay back some of what was stolen from the descendants of the people who suffered the oppression?
Well, it's an argument that you can make, but I think that there's a big danger to it. And it is that, you know, while not always quite so spectacular as the instance of slavery, all of the money, all of the wealth, all of the value, all of the culture that's floating around today is the product of previous generations, including of the injustices in them. And I think there's no one in the United States who has not had ancestors who didn't have a fair shake somewhere. That's part of being a nation of immigrants. Almost every group that comes to the United States comes at a kind of a bargaining disadvantage. So I think that there is a real danger that this principle, once introduced, will just destabilize the legitimacy of property for everyone, you know? But I think that on a more kind of idealistic level, there's also the problem that, you know, the goal of this country for at least the last 50 years has been to build a sense of us out of a sense of, you know, the old sense of kind of us and them. And you can't, I'm afraid that to have one part of the country defined by race paying money to another part of the country defined by race is a kind of a return to the us and them thinking. And actually at just the moment when things actually seem to be getting more equal.
You acknowledge at the beginning of your piece that there are many such inequalities in our system, and blacks are on the unenviable side of most of them. They possess the fewest financial assets, fare the worst in school, have the hardest time finding work, live the shortest lives, commit the most violent crime, and spend the most time in jail. I assume, like any person of goodwill, you think it would be a good thing if some of these gaps were closed and some of these disadvantages were obliterated. But what actually could be done other than some kind of massive program of discrimination in favor of past victims? What else could be done to try to help to erase some of these disadvantages?
Yeah, I'm afraid that it requires patience. And if you look at the length of time that it's taken most immigrant groups to become fully assimilated Americans, I think that most people now think it takes longer than, I mean, you can integrate, your family can integrate kind of superficially almost immediately. But to become sort of kind of indistinguishable from other Americans, it often takes two or three generations. And so I'm afraid it sometimes takes time. The question is,
but
you know,
again, it's been 400 years, as they point out in the 1619 project.
Yeah.
How much more time do we need?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's been 50 since the Civil Rights Act, you know, and I don't, you know, it depends on how much you intend to do. I mean, a lot of us think that these, you know, that the disadvantages that certain people have in this country are quite unfortunate. The question is whether they can be remedied without dismantling a whole bunch of things that are vitally important to every American, including the least fortunate among us.
And what are those things that would have to be dismantled?
Oh, private property as we understand it. You know, certain First Amendment freedoms like freedom of association, you know. I mean, the Equity Project, I think, requires a very intrusive, you know,
okay,
if you were to equalize.
Why private property? What are you talking about there? Are you just talking about people confiscating property?
I'm not saying we would abolish private property, but I'm saying that the understanding of the equity movement is that there is something illegitimate about certain races making more money than other races. And if you really have that idea of justice, there is no reason why that principle should be limited just to equalizing things between races. That principle of justice can be applied a lot of places. And so anyone who has would be vulnerable to having his property sort of, you know, taxed away, I would say.
Well, one of the points that you make in your piece, and again, the piece is posted at michaelmedved.com. One of the points you make in the piece is that people who see racism as the sole source of white people on average, and again, there are all kinds of examples of black people who do spectacularly well in America, and we're just talking about nearly half of black people now own their own homes. Black home ownership has been going down slightly since the Great Recession, which is a terrible thing, but okay, the point over here is that Asian Americans, who are not a huge chunk of the population, but getting bigger, rapidly growing chunk of the population, do better than white people in life expectancy, much better than white people in terms of educational attainment, much better than white people in terms of median income. Does that have to be adjusted? Christopher Caldwell, thought-provoking piece. Thank you for it, and thank you for joining us. When we come back, more on political prospects and developments that are surprising. Coming up on the MedVed Show. And on the Michael Medved Show, at a moment when we were sort of gobsmacked by the unexpected and sad news, and it is sad that after 27 years of marriage, Bill Gates, who is estimated to have joint value worth together with his wife Melinda of $130 billion, which is an astonishing sum when you think about it. I mean, that's more than a lot of countries have in certainly in gross national product. But they're calling it quits. Their marriage is over. They have children, two in their 20s, one who is 18. It's all terribly sad. And I do think we'll have a different perspective on it. They both apparently intend to continue their charitable work, which has been largely beneficial to lots of people and lots of causes, and has actually saved some lives. So the difficulty right now is that people like Bill Gates attract a great deal of attention. And one of the things that I worry about here is how will this impact programs of inoculation that he's been involved with, including inoculation here. I hope it will not detract from people's confidence in those kinds of benefits. And speaking of people's confidence, there is a this piece in Washington Post that I was talking about, and it's very important because basically it sounds like they interview a bunch of Democratic operatives who are all talking about, yeah, we're cooked in the House. And the one thing that they talk about a lot is retirement. They quote Dan Sena, who was the executive director for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee in 2018. In 2018, the Democrats grabbed control of the House of Representatives. I believe they won 28 seats. This is in the middle of the Trump administration, and President Trump had a controversial term. And in the middle of the Trump administration, his party lost control of Congress, which is very common. It's happened to every president except for Franklin Roosevelt in 1934 and George W. Bush in 2002, is that when a president is facing his first midterm election, congressional election, the president's party usually loses seats. The average loss is 28 seats. The Republicans will need five to take command of the House. Dan Sena, the head of the executive director for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee back in 2018, he said, in that year, my year, there is no doubt that Republican retirements and late redrawing of maps made a significant difference in our ability to win additional seats. Washington Post writes, now those advantages are more likely to go to Republicans. Only one Republican from a competitive seat, Representative Lee Zeldin, Republican of New York, has signaled so far that he will leave the House to run for governor. That, of course, is the gubernatorial seat held by the very shaky Andrew Cuomo. The other three announced GOP retirements from safe Republican districts. Three additional Democratic seats are vacant, with special elections to fill them planned for this year. Democratic strategists are betting that the infighting in the Republican Party, the extremism on display during the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, and the sheer scale of the trillion-dollar programs that Democrats have pushed through this year leads to a reorienting of partisan divisions that can overcome historical patterns. Okay, there's another piece, and this in the Wall Street Journal, about why the reorienting of partisan divisions might not be in the Democrats' direction. It, headline, Republicans' blue-collar agenda is still a work in progress. But what it shows is that among voters who describe themselves as blue-collar, who are 18% of all voters, this is in a Wall Street Journal, NBC News survey, and that's all voters of all races. So we're not now just talking about the famous white working class. We're talking about the working class, period. 18% of all voters, the Republicans have a decided advantage. The Republicans are just under 50% who identification with self-described blue-collar voters. And Democrats are down at 29%. Now, if that holds, and it's hard to say that Joe Biden, with his tremendous spending programs, that is going to be something that endears him, in particular, to blue-collar people. But obviously, there is that that general Democratic belief that spending lots and lots and lots of government money and spreading it around will help to make them more popular. That remains to be seen. It didn't work in the first congressional election for Bill Clinton, and it didn't work for Barack Obama, who 2 years into his presidency lost 63 seats in the House, I believe it was. It was a wipeout. Val Demings, remember her? She had been a potential vice president for Joe Biden. She apparently is getting ready to leave her seat in Orlando, Florida, another competitive seat. Why? Because she's looking to running for either governor or U.S. Senate. Now, of course, that'd be great if they have a Florida governor's race to run against Ron DeSantis, who almost surely will be running for re-election. If they have a Florida governor's race in the primary between Charlie Crist, who is a sleazy operator. He is not one of my favorite politicians. But Charlie Crist versus Val Demings, who's, of course, a former police chief, lifelong cop, African-American, and very popular in Florida. I think that could be more bad news for Democrats giving up another seat in Florida. There's also a tweet, and I think that this would count as our tweet of the day, and I'm going to need some help with it. Tweet of the day, Jeremy?
Turn the page now to the internet. To the internet.
I mean, wow, what a great, smart tweet.
Change his password so he no longer has access to his Twitter feed.
Did you send the tweet?
I did not send that tweet. My system was hacked. I was pranked.
Donald Trump hasn't tweeted at us once, and I'm starting to get worried about him.
So we have a new tweet.
All right.
Can I do the honors?
Stand by. Tweet alert.
Okay, this is from Cori Bush, the young squad member newly elected to Congress. She's from Missouri. And she writes, our communities wouldn't have needed to spark a national movement to save black lives if America weren't racist AF. What does AF stand for? And no, I'm serious. If somebody knows if you can send a quick email to our show, you can... Or you can call if you want, 1-800-955-1770. Jeremy just said no, because his assumption is that AF might stand for something that the FCC doesn't want to hear. And if the FCC doesn't want to hear it, given the fact that they fine you, that's good enough for me. We will be right back with... Well, one of the issues is, should your boss have the right to stop you from talking politics at work? Coming up. The very essence of racism, right? I mean, I think people can understand that. Is to put more importance, to attach more value or more significance to someone's racial origins than to their character, their behavior, their intelligence, their ability, anything. And it also involves judging someone more harshly because he or she is a person of color. Listen to an MSNBC host named Tiffany Cross speaking about Senator Tim Scott, who is a Republican. He's one of three elected Republicans in the United States Congress. He's not the only one, as people have erroneously said. And people like Burgess Owens, who's been a guest on the show several times, as Senator Scott has, of course. Burgess Owens is another example, and Congressman Donald of Florida, newly elected. So leave that aside, but listen to what Tiffany Cross has to say about Tim Scott.
This week, the sole black Republican in the Senate sounded a stone fool when he said this.
Hear me clearly. America is not a racist country.
Okay, let's be clear. Tim Scott does not represent any constituency other than the small number of sleepy, slow-witted sufferers of Stockholm Syndrome who get elevated to prominence for repeating a false narrative about this country that makes conservative white people feel comfortable. Because when you speak an uncomfortable truth, like Nicole Hannah-Jones, the party that Scott claims is not racist gets big mad and tries to silence you. Just this week, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell asked Education Secretary Miguel Cardona to scrap teaching the 1619 Project in schools because it would reorient the view of American history. Lucky for McConnell, he has his own tap dancer to try and reorient the view of America for him. There were so many contradictions in the senator's speech that it was clear not even Scott believed the words he was speaking. I could go into great detail refuting each of his asinine points, but he did that for me. And moreover, a lesson I've learned, don't argue with people Harriet Tubman would have left behind.
Don't argue with people Harriet Tubman would have left behind. She's referring, of course, to the fact that Harriet Tubman was famous as a what was called a conductor on the Underground Railroad. After she ran away successfully from slavery and found a new home in Philadelphia and then later in upstate New York, she went back into southern states, primarily her own state of Maryland, and rescued other slaves. This is appalling. It's just appalling. In other words, you notice the way she laughs with a little titter at the whole idea, hear me now, America is not a racist country. I think if there was flat-out honest polling on that, and let's say she's talking about the 1619 Project and the desire to prevent it from being injected into our educational system. The 1619 Project, the basic premise of it is that America didn't really begin in 1776, as people suggest. It began in 1619. The key event in American history was not the writing of the Declaration of Independence or the Revolutionary War or the drafting of the Constitution. No, no, no. The key defining element in American history was the first arrival of 23, I believe it was, slaves in Jamestown, Virginia in 1619. And that's what we should mark as the beginning of American history. Again, it is absurd. You should have the right to talk about it. No one is banning the right to talk about it in schools. But to make it part of the curriculum where you get marked wrong if you are asked a question. In other words, if the 1619 Project is taken to its logical conclusion, you then have a situation where if you are asked a question, when was America founded? If you answer the question correctly and say 1776, wrong. No, 1619, of course. It's an absurdity. And by the way, the entire piece is riddled with errors. And all of this shows what success Tim Scott has had. And I think we'll continue to raise his stock with Americans of every race and every political orientation. I do not believe that a majority of Democrats, I don't believe a majority of Democrats would prefer that we honor or dishonor or curse 1619 as the beginning of the American experience. This goes to as core a question. If you mark 1619 as the beginning of American experience, you believe that the development of the United States of America was a bad thing for the world, and you're an idiot. Anyone who believes that is so appallingly ignorant and so blind to the facts of history for the last 250 years, that it's almost it's almost not worth talking about, but it's too prevalent not to talk about it. Speaking of something that is, it seems to me, worth talking about, the Wall Street Journal reporting the Biden administration intends to pursue a ban on menthol cigarettes, a policy move that could sweep from the market more than a third of all cigarettes sold in the U.S., people familiar with the matter said. 84% of black smokers in the U.S. use menthol cigarettes. So what I don't understand is, since we are now saying that we're going to ban the cigarettes of choice for black people, is that not an act of discrimination?
Answering that question with specificity is above my pay grade.
Okay, reputed menthol cigarettes to be preferred by Barack Obama, who never was able to kick the smoking habit. Look, do I think it's necessarily a bad idea? Apparently, menthol cigarettes are easier to get addicted to and to draw people into tobacco, including young people. And, okay, so I think you can argue about the ban or not, but it seems to me, given the fact that this is so overwhelmingly a black habit, doesn't this, the menthol cigarette habit, but generally blacks are less likely to smoke than white people. But this idea not being viewed in a racial lens, well, here's something that isn't viewed in a racial lens at all. And it's actually one of the better movies of the year so far. It's playing in theaters. It's going to be available for streaming in a couple of weeks. And it features two enormously gifted stars. Listen.
Now it's time for Medved's Entertainment Minute.
A totally deglamorized Mila Kunis plays a struggling heroin addict who desperately needs the help of her estranged and skeptical mother, Glenn Close, in a searingly intense dramatization of a true story called Four Good Days. Now playing in theaters and soon available for streaming everywhere.
Wish I'd been around.
You should have been.
You think it's my fault that you're an addict?
This brutally honest film is difficult to watch, but impossible to forget. It's brilliantly directed by Colombian filmmaker Rodrigo Garcia, the son of Nobel Prize-winning novelist Gabriel Garcia Marquez. The horrors of our opioid crisis and the indestructible complexities of the mother-daughter bond are on full display. Rated R for graphic scenes of drug abuse and loads of harsh language. 3 stars for the utterly compelling Four Good Days.
This feature brought to you by the Thank Heaven Foundation.
And on the Michael Medved Show tomorrow, there's a fairly amazing story. And it's a story about a murder suspect. His name is Jason Carlos Strover. He's 20. And he has a big neck tattoo that reads RISK on it. And reporter Matt Johnson and photojournalist Joe Booker were prepping their story when all of a sudden the murder suspect ran right past their live truck and darted into some nearby bushes. What happened next? We will tell you tomorrow on the Medved Show. There is also this story, and again, it's a business section story, but it has much, much deeper implications that employers are increasingly tending to forbid political talk. Now, already there are a lot of workplaces where they won't allow you to try to proselytize for people, to try to convert them to your religion. But are you allowed to try to convert them politically? And if not, what happened to your First Amendment rights that checked at the workplace door? We will cover that as well on the Medved Show, and also talk about the latest in the plan to spend $6 trillion to guarantee democratic rule in this greatest nation on God's green earth.
If Ernest Hemingway was alive,